Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to our eighth weekly Teneo Insights call on the impact of COVID-19. We're all waiting to hear what the government is going to do about ending the lockdown, but it's increasingly clear it won't be right to call it an exit plan because many of the restrictions will remain until we can find a vaccine or a cure. In reality, there'll be some softening, but the vast majority of people will be told to work from home if they can. It's also clear that even if significant numbers of people were to return to work, our public transport system and offices would struggle to cope in an age of social distancing. So huge amounts to discuss again today, and we've got another great panel to take us through it all. They are Mark Weinberger, a Teneo senior advisor who was until recently the global chairman and CEO of EY. He's currently on the board of some of the biggest companies in the world, and so will be well placed to offer his perspective on what companies should be doing and considering. Amber Rudd is a regular on these calls. She's also a Teneo senior advisor and former Home Secretary. She'll discuss the government response to the crisis. Lord Davis is also familiar to you. He's a Teneo senior advisor too and the former CEO of Standard Chartered. He was central to the government's response to the 2008 financial crisis and will discuss the lessons of COVID-19 with us. And Wolf Pickerley is co-president of Teneo's risk practice, and he will analyze trends in handling COVID-19 around the world. But before we get the panel started, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the right, top right of your screen, you can see there's a chat function there. You can type in your questions, and please use your name if you feel able to. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on the call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. So that done, let's get to it. And let's start with you, Amber. A big week for the government coming up. What can we expect?
Yes, a big week for the government. And the government is doing, Craig, what you and I would have done in the past in government, which is frozen with indecision. It's decided to buy some time. So instead of hearing this week about what the next stage is going to be, we're hearing on Sunday. I also think it's interesting that the government has decided not to do it in the House of Commons. It may sound trivial externally to people, but it is pretty significant to make announcements like this outside the House of Commons. And there will, of course, be some kickback from the newly revitalised Labour. But as you said, I think that we're much more likely to see an easing rather than an end to a lockdown. And there are two main factors that will influence how they move ahead with that. The first is obviously the economy and how people are now, how the people and the government are becoming increasingly aware of the scale of the damage that people staying out of work is doing. Various people think the market has got further to go down. There are some real consequences to the tax receipts, to the scale of the downturn we're experiencing at the moment. And there is a certain practical urgency to making sure that we get people back to work. So they're thinking about that, but they're also thinking about the health consequences, obviously. But the health consequences are not just of the consequence of people going out to work and potentially being infected, but the growing awareness of the health consequences of the lockdown, mental health, cancer, the fact that people aren't going to hospitals. This is building up a real health problem separate to the virus overall. So that is a big issue for the government, trying to work out what level of easing they can allow. But the second point is about how to have confidence in what type of easing will result in what kind of consequences. Again, the government is always talking about being led by the science. Governments like to give the impression that there is certainty about the consequences of certain actions. Well, we know enough about the virus to know that we cannot be sure about consequences of certain actions. And we know enough about people and the economy to know, again, we can't be sure, even if the easing of the lockdown takes place, whether people will go back to work. The government has so successfully frightened people into staying at home. There are a lot of people who just think, I'm going to make my own decision and possibly not go back to work, not send my children to school. Take up of children's places at schools for key workers was tiny. And that reflects the fact people are nervous of going outside, as they should be, because the government has put that message out so successfully and clearly. So easing of the lockdown is going to take some really careful management about what the messaging is. Yes, to get some people back to work, but to do it in a way that gives purpose so that the people who can help to restart the economy do actually take that seriously and don't take their own decision to stay at home. But the second point about the easing of the lockdown, which is in the government's favour, really, is the fact that we can look around and see what's working in different countries. So Germany went further than most other European countries this week by announcing the opening of certain services. Me and my colleagues were very jealous of the fact that German hairdressers are now open with certain restrictions. So I think that we'll be able to look around Europe and see who's managed to make it work, how they've managed to affect it, reassure people, and basically reopen the economy. And because all European countries are now measuring the infection rate quite carefully, we'll be able to see quite soon whether there is a consequence to it. So in a way, being a laggard on opening from the UK government's point of view is an advantage because we can look around and see what's happening elsewhere. Finally, a final word about the indecision in the government itself. There is still an ongoing conflict about what to prioritise, whether to prioritise restoring the economy and taking some risk with it, or whether to continue the lockdown in a really vigilant way in order to make sure that it's clear. The consequence for the second is, of course, increasingly bad for the economy, but it also, to go back to my first point, will buy the government some time getting the test, track and tracing system up and running. It's already being started in the Isle of Wight. It seems like it's going to be ahead of the vaccine in terms of an answer. Buying some time now is what government is trying to do, but hopefully in a way that's not going to cripple our economy.
Thank you, Amber. I can say, looking across the screen, that the panel's haircuts are all looking pretty good. Mark Weinberger, I just wanted to say to you, thank you for joining us. I know it's early in the United States. Until very recently, you were a global CEO and chairman of EY, a business with many employees. It feels like we're in for a very long haul. How do you think businesses should be reacting, and what's your take on it all?
Well, thanks, Craig, and it's great to be with everyone. Amber, great comments. I do think this is a very, very tough time for business to lead, obviously. We've been through many crises before. Mervyn has helped many of us get through the financial crisis that existed before. The uniqueness of this one is the speed at which it came on, so no one was prepared, and just the magnitude of potential outcomes because of the virus being on one end, now the economic consequences on the second. And the fact that the whole world has not taken the same approach, even within the United States, we have states taking very different approaches for, as Amber referred to, opening up again. And you have to be cognizant of that. A CEO at this point is probably, and is, I can tell you, either from my board roles or from the ones I still can talk with, moving from the crisis assessment mode. We have liquidity, we understand our supply chain issues, we know our people are scared and we've tried to take care of them. We've looked at the various risks that we've always focused on and continue to evolve that to now a new assessment stage. And the assessment stage is more about recognizing that everything is interdependent, that a business cannot make decisions on reopening without looking at local rules and then maybe national rules, without understanding what their employees are willing to do. As Amber alluded to, many workers, even when they want to go back to work and a business wants them back at work because of childcare, they will not be able to leave home or will not financially be able to make it. We'll have massive issues with transportation in general, especially in the bigger cities where people have to move lots of folks through either a subway system or a bus system, and what are the rules going to be? All these externalities come into play. So it's really important now for businesses to be taking in data from all of their stakeholders and understanding where their psyche is of those people, their consumers, their customers, their employees, as well as the governments around the world. And then moving from what's crucial, which is financial strength, continuing to have financial strength, because many are predicting we'll see this resurgence again in the fall. We don't know, but this could come back. So you're going to want to be very much still focused on risk more than we have been in the past. Technological efficiency, we know, is a key, whether it's more mobile workers, whether it's consumers wanting to buy more from a distance, whether it's changing the way we transact is real, and everyone is looking at that and accelerating e-commerce and technology platform investments. And then just having agility around your organizational model and understanding that because, as Amber said, you don't have the answers. There is uncertainties. You have to be authentic about that. You have to remain very nimble in terms of where we're going. When we come out the other side, Craig, I think, brand strength, your people, how they're acting, how they're engaged, how they're going to work is going to be incredibly important, and the ability to understand and assess the changes in your consumer and customer base in terms of what they're going to want and do differently. And that's what a lot of CEOs are trying to do now. They're focusing on operating their business for sure, but trying to anticipate where it's going to be. And I'll finish with the board perspective. You know, we really try and stay out of the way of management, who is so stressed right now with all they're doing, but trying to bring our own individual expertise and just ask the right questions about making sure we continue to prioritize the workers. We continue to make sure our purpose of our organizations is front and center. We continue to make sure we're looking for long-term steps that we're taking to be around, not just for the next 3 months, but for the 6, 12, 18 months, and not just focus short-term. All these things are the questions that boards should really be helping on. Management at this point is pretty much understanding their internal operations, but getting them to make that pivot, as I referred to, and move externally is, I think, where we're at right now. And opening up is going to be a huge question in terms of whether or not employers have excess liabilities now, have new requirements now, are they prepared for structurally how to deal with it now? A whole bunch of new and interesting topics for us to turn to and talk about in the next 5 or 6 calls.
Thank you, Mark. That was really fascinating. And Mervyn Davis, the 2008 banking crisis was absolutely huge. Huge numbers of books have been written about it. It's been something that's very much in the psyche of us for a long time. But it feels like the economic damage of COVID-19 is going to be of a completely different level, and people are only just beginning to realize the extent of it. Could you talk to that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, just building on what's already been said, you know, the press this morning commented on, you know, car registration in the UK down 97.3%. You've seen the announcement yesterday on Gatwick and, you know, the Virgin announcement, but also you then look at the announcement about how many people are dependent on government aid. So I'm afraid I'm going to bring an even more depressing tone to it. This is very quickly moving from a health crisis to an economic crisis. And I think for business leaders, it's always true you have to be authentic, but authenticity now is even more important than ever, because you actually don't know what's going to happen over the next few months. So in every type of scenario plan, the people listening to the call, you have to do extreme scenario plans, because your staff are going to be very nervous about commuting. They may want their holidays now. They want a different lifestyle now. They may want, you know, flexi time on a permanent basis. I think the other thing, the dilemma, and this is a moral dilemma, a huge challenge for every government, you know, the human cost of a health crisis versus the economic cost. And, you know, my view is that the easing of the lockdown, it is going to be easing. And as you take people off furlough, then you are then taking the full cost of the employee, but your revenue is not coming in. So I fear that the real economic sort of pressure is going to be in the summer or the autumn when your cash flow is under strain. I think the other thing that, which, you know, is really the good news out of all this is the businesses have cut through huge bureaucracies. It doesn't matter whether you're a small business or a big business. You've been very creative on digital, you know, how you handle your teams, how we run meetings. And we've done it so quickly, we've adapted to a new world. So I think this is going to speed up the digital economy. But what it's also going to do is make every company look at their supply chain, look at their methods of working, look at how many employees do they really need for the new environment. I think really for a public company, I'll say this wherever I go, it's very difficult to connect with the stock market about what your prediction is on your future profits. So the danger for public companies is they mislead the market on direction. So because where I'm sitting, there's a disconnect between where the equity market is and where the real economy is. And the only reason for that is because governments have flooded the world with cash. So here we have a world that's economically struggling, but huge liquidity everywhere. I think the final point is we are forgetting that we've also got Brexit. You hear the you know rumors that we're looking for a WTO deal, etc. So I think that we're in for a very, very difficult summer. And my fear, which Mark might was alluding to, is in the US, you've got the fear of litigation from employees. And then in the UK, we're not as litigious, but you definitely have to engage in a different way with your employees. You've got to get them together and really understand the choices on commuting, how you work, how you engage, how you're going to call on your customers. So it's a, it's, you know, I think for the rest of the year, we're in a very different environment. My final comment would be around the creative industries and sport. I think the creative industries has been one of the great strengths of the UK, you know, just under 10% of the economy. It's facing destruction. I mean, there's no other word for it, really. And we have got to figure out, the government has to figure out how it's going to help the creative industries. And I've mentioned on previous calls, I'm very involved in the sports industry. Wow, I mean, you know, it's Armageddon. It's really, it's a crisis that we've never had before. So creative industries, leisure, sport, F&B. And my final comment was the airline industry now say that if they get their turnover up to 40% of what it was before by the end of the year, that would be huge success for them. Put that into perspective of what the economic impact of that is, it's all downside.
Mervyn, that's very sobering and fascinating as well. Just to remind people before we go to Wolf that to go to the chat function at the top right hand corner of the screen, do put in some questions. There's lots of things that I think have been raised by this, lots of big themes, and we'd love to get your questions to put to the panel. But let's finish this part of the call with you, Wolf. Take us through what you think is going on at a kind of global geopolitical level. Wolf, I think you may be on mute. Can you hear us, Wolf?
I think you're on. Start on a positive note on mute.
You're on.
Is that on now? Yeah, okay. I was actually trying to start on a positive note. I was on mute. The positive note, and when we look at the 27, I'm putting aside the UK here because we discussed already, the number of cases are going down. They are going down in 26 countries. The only country that is going against the trend is actually Bulgaria. However, when we look at the 14-day notification period, which is a more reliable kind of measure, we still have four countries in Europe where we haven't seen substantial changes in terms of new cases. That's Romania, that's Poland, that is Sweden, and is the UK. The other interesting thing here, and we highlighted that to clients for a long time, exit, the opening, was going to be much more difficult than locking. And they are, and in terms, and they are there. If we are looking to learn something from what we have seen from continental Europe, my concern is that there is not much to learn, because we have seen lots of different kind of approaches, which suggest that we still don't know much at all about the spread of the virus, how to try to contain it. It's still far too early to see whether these approaches are working. And on top of this, I think, if we want to learn, there are two shared traits here when we look at continental Europe so far. First, the issue of easing the restriction has become immediately very, very political. So the level of contestation, recrimination, is already much higher than we have seen during the public health emergency crisis. Second, government across the board have failed to instill confidence in the public. And let me try to unpack it a bit. On the political front, in Italy, for example, Prime Minister Conte, at the peak of the crisis, the ratings were at 71%, almost unprecedented for an Italian Prime Minister. Well, since the public has shifted their attention from the public health to the economy, the rating of content have gone down, downfall. There are already rumors about content being kicked out soon. In Spain today, there is a vote to extend the emergency rule. For the first time, the main opposition party will vote against it. Sanchez will still get a majority, but clearly things are getting complicated there. In France, 300 mayors are now complaining to Macron about his idea of reopening schools on the 11th of May, and 65% of the French are unwilling to send their kids to school on the 11th of May. In Germany, generally considered as a good case, a low death rate and everything else, the 16 leaders of the various lenders have already taken their initiative in their hands in terms of easing, and now Merkel is just trying to catch up to try to save face. Trade unions in France, Germany, Spain, and even in Germany are calling on employers to be very cautious about calling back workers to work. The issue is becoming more political, there are more recrimination, more contestation, more groups involved in the world debate. The world rally around the flag is quickly evaporating. If you think about this, then the question becomes, if something goes wrong, if for whatever reason we have a second wave and we have to reinstall lockdowns, how long is going to take to create the consensus required, the political consensus required to go back into lockdown? That is something to consider here. The other issue that I mentioned before, confidence. When we look at opinion polls in terms of the public about the idea of reopening, going back to work, the level of confidence are fairly low, which is not particularly surprising, because you are asking now, you have taken away civil liberties from people, now you are giving them back, but you're asking individuals to do a risk assessment every day, where they want to go out to work, where they want to go out to shop, where they want to spend some of their money to buy things, and they need to feel confident about their status as employees and so on. So when we look at numbers there is an analysis that done by Ipsos, 14 key economies. When you ask people whether they would be willing to go back to work even if the virus is not contained, above 50% is only in four countries: China, India, Italy, and Russia. In the UK, it's 23%. When you ask people whether they will still be very nervous when the lockdown is eased, is basically, apart from Germany and Italy, in all the others, the majority feels very, very nervous about that. So here, clearly, governments are struggling to instill a sense of confidence. And if there is no confidence, you know, the easing is all about confidence and the lack of fear. If there is no confidence, we are in a bit of a problem. My final point here, we are not going back to the normal. We are heading to somewhere, to something that is still very abnormal. And for me, as a political scientist, what is interesting here, that the abnormal is not just about the social distancing, the mask, the hygienic rules, but also about countries. We are carving up countries here. In France, there isn't a one easing plan. There are 101 based on each district, because in each district, the government will look at the level of cases and determine whether you can open or not. 101 districts in France. In Spain, is done by province. In Italy, today, we can go to the beach in Sardinia, but we cannot go to the beach in Emilia-Romagna. We can go and have a coffee in Campania, in a bar, but we cannot do it anywhere else in the country. You can travel within the region, but you cannot travel to other regions. So even the idea of nation states here is being challenged by the reality of the virus. And certainly that is an issue for business. You know, decentralization here for companies got multiple sites, it becomes a nightmare to handle, basically. Let me stop there and happy to take any question. And thank you again.
Thank you, Wolf. Look, well, let's start on that last point that you were making there, that essentially the lockdown sounds fairly chaotic, not just comparing countries, but also within countries. and the easing of it, and how do we change that? I'm just interested in just nailing this, because I think it is the big thought that is in people's minds. And let's go through the panel. What is your expectation in terms of the level of change that we can see, and on what timescale, Amber?
I think the first thing we're going to have is more spelling out of what you are actually allowed to do now. I think the government was initially surprised at the amount of manufacturing that closed, at the lack of ability of companies to impose social distancing and stay open. So I think that first of all, we'll just see, you know what, you can go back to work if you can have social distancing, we will help you do it. So there'll be an encouragement to start with, and I think an acceptance of what a lot of people are doing, which is moving around a bit more than had been expected as well. But as I've said in earlier comments, the big comment is going to be about getting people to work, the big challenge with transport, how they fix that. So I think that we'll see it in stages, and it'll start on Sunday by gently easing, reassuring people they can do certain things, and then step up from there.
Mark, the US is a country of extremes. You've got situations with very densely populated cities, much, much more diffuse populations in other states. You've also got a system where the governors are making decisions and in conflict with each other. Spell out how you think it's going to play out in the states.
So, yeah, you hit the nail on the head, Craig. I mean, we are a microcosm of the world with 50 states and a district. And within each state, you take New York, which is heavily populated. New York City is very different than Upper State, where there's not a lot of public transportation and a lot of mass people in one spot. You know, Craig, you asked the question the right way, in my view. How are we going to get back, and how should we think about this over what time frame? I don't want to avoid the question, but I think our memories are shorter than we always think they are in the middle of a crisis. I remember after the financial crisis, the view was the financial markets are never going to be the same. We're never going to take on the level of debt we did in the past. Before this pandemic, we had the highest level of debt we ever had at the government and local company level in the world. After 9/11, the United States, we were never going to fly again because of fear of flying, and they put in, you know, all these tests at the airport. And airlines grew phenomenally 3 years later. I think it's more important than ever, Craig, for businesses to focus on the signal, not the noise. There's going to be a lot of up and downs and closings and openings, but longer term, focus. Don't lose sight of what the real trends are that we've been talking about. We are going to have acceleration of a number of trends. We will have increased digitization. We will have more remote working, right? We're going to have more employees, consumers, and tastes and preferences different. Mervyn was talking about, airlines and industries and how they're going to change. Remember, everyone's cost is someone else's revenue. I can tell you at EY, at my old firm, they had 90% or 80% of their 300,000 people flying around the world every week. It went down to 2% or 3%. It's not going to go back to 90, but it won't stay at 2. It's going to be somewhere in the middle. That affects the airplanes. And then the airplanes affects the air part manufacturers and the workers at the airports. And so all I'm saying, no one is going to be able to figure out all the governments and what they're going to do at what time frame. But what's most important now for any good business leader is to think longer term, manage through the short term, but continue to gather data, reassess your strategy, reassess where your business operations are going to be when we come out of this 6, 12, 18 months from now by talking to your stakeholders, your clients, your consumers, your employees over and over and over again, and constantly retesting that data.
And Mervyn, these doubts over the speed and time frame of this are a real challenge for business leaders.
I don't think so. Look, as Mark says, we'll get back to business, and this is just speeding up, digitalization of the economy. But I think the overarching sort of change is we've got more state intervention than we would ever have dreamt of or wanted. I think we're going to go through an era of employee power, where employees really have a voice. I think the unions are going to be more vocal than they have been in the previous decade. So I think that's something we will, because they have a stage. But I think the other thing is that, as Mark said, stakeholder engagement, which is good for Teneo, stakeholder engagement has never been more important. How you communicate with your consumers, how you keep your staff on side, and how you make sure that your shareholders don't run away with an expectation that things are going to go back to normal, you're going to make this amount of EPS or quarterly earnings. I think there is one other thing, which is right across the world, is that every country has issued debt. And we saw in the UK, there wasn't that much demand for Treasury, for the Treasury bills last week. We've also seen in the US this huge explosion of US debt, and the Chinese have bought the debt. So I think one of the things that's not come up this morning is I am very concerned about the anti-Chinese sentiment that's going to develop in the world. Very concerned. And what that will do is really add another complicated issue, which is trade wars and trade. So I think that's looming. But I think, look, you run a business, you've got to be flexible, you're going to get back on, you're going through this crisis, and then you'll get back onto thinking, okay, I've got a new world, I've got a different way of engaging as a CEO or as a board, as Mark said, and what are we going to do to survive and get back to normal?
Okay, that's interesting. Let's pick up on the China point that you were making there. It seems inevitable that anybody who understands politics can see where Trump and his campaign are going, that China is going to become a whipping boy in all of this. I just wonder, Mark and Wolf, if you've got any thoughts on that. Mark?
Yeah, I do. And I'm sure Wolf has a lot of good insights here. I would say this is another one, the signal versus the noise. So if you look today as a business leader, you would be pulling out of China, because decoupling and the sentiment in the United States is terrible against China right now, because whether or not they believe that somehow they did handle this virus well, whether they believe they're stealing US technology, whether they believe they're dumping things, that's what the American people have been fed by government leaders now for a while. You would think emerging markets, where we've seen a tremendous exodus of capital and huge issues with their debt loads, and they're much worse than even the developed markets, that it's the worst place in the world to be investing. You should pull everything back to the United States. But if you did that, over the long term, you would miss the fact that 90% of the people alive on Earth under the age of 30 live in an emerging market, that China is by far the biggest, has more people in the middle class than the entire population in the United States, and its income is growing as fast. I mean, you've got to continue to look for the long term and get through this political jarring back and forth. In my view, you've got to be thinking still globally. I do not believe personally that the waves of globalization have been turned back over time. There will be very different ways to operate globally, with changing your supply chains to have more dual capacity to protect yourselves and things like that. I do worry. I think Mervyn said it well. I think decoupling, and whether or not we move to export controls from the United States and additional moves to stop companies from buying technology from China, things like that, coming up with two or three different technology backbones around the world for 5G will be truly devastating in terms of the global economy when Europe has to choose whether to buy US or China technology goods and can't have both in their supply chain. Those type of things are going to be very interesting to watch politically over time. That could have major effects on countries and businesses in particular.
The Wolf, China in the US election?
China will be the whipping.
Yeah, and can I just say that's a very important point, because Biden obviously is going to, I'm sorry, I know you're going to Wolf, but I want to say this. This is what will be, in my view, Trump's campaign policy, is to paint Biden as Mr. China, and that's going to be more important than almost anything else.
Yeah, Wolf.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, remember the previous election, it was Mexico and NAFTA. You always need an enemy. China is a perfect enemy. What is interesting about Trump and other people in his administration commenting on China over the last few days, there are two things that I've not mentioned. The trade arrangement, because there is still the willingness by Trump to claim that was a big victory, even if China actually is not even in the position now to meet some of this commitment. And the other thing that has not been mentioned by Trump is President Xi. So yes, so China, the whipping boy, but still with like some sort of caution here from the administration. So that will be remain with us. And the other issue to consider here is that China also, at least as far as Europe is concerned, for example, the China opening, the trying to sell themselves in some positive ways after the, you know, the spreading of the virus has been managed very poorly. So the Chinese, they don't seem to be that sophisticated in terms of their own PR in Europe so far. So even if they've been sending material, medical equipment, doctors and so on, it has not paid off because it created all sorts of alarmism and so on. And you see that in a variety of European countries. So yes, China is could be here a bit the victim, if you want to put it, but also on their side, they're not helping themselves. Let's put it that, let me put it in that way.
Okay.
And could I ask Amber, sorry, Craig, could I ask Amber, you know, in the financial crisis, the G7, G20, whatever one thinks about it, it did come together, and you know, and China was very much at the table. Here, it just feels as if the world is just everybody's looking after their own country, and there's no, you know, and obviously we've got the WHO attacked by Trump, but it feels as if the world hasn't come together at the governance level, you know.
Yes, I mean, I agree. It's something we really, really lack. And, you know, if we compare it, for instance, to climate change, which is the other big challenge, really, the world has come together up to a point, and we have had various international meetings which under the UN, which have yielded some success. But the problem in this one, I feel, is that we just don't have any US leadership. The absence, in fact, the opposite of leadership coming from the US is what stops there being any proper world response. And I think that that's what we are all suffering from at the moment.
Okay, let me just move on to what is probably really the biggest story of the week, which is that the UK has the highest death toll in the world, apart from the United States. What does it say about the two countries, the two economies, the two ways of doing things that that is the case? So let's start with you on that one.
Well, I mean, the government line, of course, Craig, as you know, is you can't really compare them to each other at the moment. There are different cities, there are different age groups, different obesity levels, we will see. But I mean, I think it's impossible.
No, I don't.
I'm just saying it's impossible not to look at those results and say we must have done many things wrong. I mean, I would come back to the fact that Boris Johnson, you know, with Dominic Cummings, is on his own. They don't have cabinet ministers who they listen to. They don't have any able politicians who are really have authority alongside them. The person who's been making the best calling on this has been Jeremy Hunt, and he's on the back benches. I think the absence of able, experienced cabinet ministers, I might say this, I would, wouldn't I, has been felt at the top.
Yeah, and Mark, this thing again about the United States is not only not showing global leadership, it's also not acting as a country. It's had 50 yeah. different governments.
Well, yeah, I mean, the country's very divided. Let's say we have a big election coming up in November for the president again, and it's a very divided country. And this will go, following on Mervyn's term of accelerating trends, this is going to be accelerated by the pandemic. We'll have more income inequality. We'll have more division between the coasts and the center of the country that are feeling this pandemic very differently. And that's true for countries across the world as well. I'm not surprised there are differences. I don't think you can compare them honestly across the board. I think if you have a very strong centralized government that could look in people and take away certain civil liberties and rights that other countries think are more valuable than the maybe keeping people locked down, they're going to approach it very differently. And that's the same as you see technology develop across the world. The privacy issues in the U.S. very different than the in parts of Asia, and that affects that as well. So that's not, I don't think this is that different, Craig, than most things where the government and the cultures are different. You're going to see different approaches over time. I wouldn't count out the U.K. or the U.S. Just because they have a higher death toll, which is very, very unfortunate personally, is not thriving after this is over. I think they both will.
Okay. I mean, look, I think Claire has asked a question, and I think I know the answer to it. What do Misrud and Mervyn think will be the impact of the current hard Brexit strategy of the government on the supply chain of the NHS next January, on the economy? Mervyn.
No idea. I think... no, but seriously, just going back one step, I think we are entering, the mood has changed subtly into a bit of attack on individuals, and we've seen the scientist issue in the UK. But the look back that's going to happen on this is going to be so profound and unpleasant. That's a challenge. I do think the business relationship with governments across the world is changing and it's going to have to change. And I think that that is, when you talk about the NHS, that is going to result in a deep dive review of the supply chain of the NHS, its funding and its structure. And that is a hugely difficult challenge, but it's definitely going to happen. The general public will demand that there's action on the NHS, number one. I think on Brexit, what you hear is that they're very keen on getting the deal done by the end of the year, and it's WTO terms, and let's get on with it. But Amber may have a closer,
Amber, a perspective on it. Just puffing up their chests and looking tight, or is it real, do you think?
No, I think it's real. But I mean, as we know, this government, it can say it's real and it's definitely going to do it and then change its mind and call it something else. So that is still a possibility. But we should all prepare for our Brexit because, the Prime Minister, I think, believes that it's a reasonable prospect and it won't do too much damage. Meanwhile, it's acting basically as a sort of internal fiscal stimulus because the government is spending billions on preparing for a hard Brexit. And unemployment, of course, will be going up, but not in the area of customs officials, where there are going to be plenty who are going to be recruited to prepare for that. But your caller particularly asked about the NHS, and that's interesting because, as Mervyn was saying, the NHS is now going to be carved out as a completely different entity to the rest of people or corporates or public sector elements suffering from hard Brexit. The NHS is going to be different. We've already seen the Home Office treating NHS employees differently to other employees. I think we'll see more of that. We'll see more funding for the NHS, not surprisingly. But your caller asking about the supply chain, anything to do with the NHS is in a very strong position going forward, and I would expect it to be protected from a hard Brexit.
A question for Wolf and Mark, I think. Yvonne Hilst saying the government intervention to prop up industry and persons is clear. The US plans to issue $3 trillion in debt. Given the world is wrapped up in the same crisis, who can buy the paper? At what point do governments have to shift to printing money instead? And then please comment on the resulting inflation risk. So Wolf, let's start with you.
On the inflation risk, I think is very low. Very few economists, they think there is an inflation risk. Actually, the real risk, in my view, when we take a sort of 24 months view, is deflation. It's not inflation here. Let's not forget also where oil prices are. Do we expect people to start spending big time given the economic uncertainties that are becoming painfully clear by the day? So I would say deflation rather than inflation here. What else can the government do? But on the fiscal side here, it depends from country to country. The situation is not particularly rosy in most of the developed economies. You know, debt to GDP is around 100% on average and is getting worse by the day. The question for me also, leaving aside money and how much money you want and you are able to print, is actually the ability to spend that money in a timely and effective way, meaning supporting business, supporting individuals on time with the proper strategies. And that is where the winner will be countries where there is a good, solid public administration with a good technology able to deliver this, and the strugglers would be the countries where the public administration is not for the job, where the decentralization is far too strong, and so on. And we already see significant differences when I look at the countries that I normally cover in continental Europe. There are huge problems there. So that is, I will not just look at the headlines figures. It's very easy to say that you are putting together a package of 400, 500 billion pounds, but if you are not able to deliver it, then we still have a problem.
Thank you. Mark, Ian Russell is also asking, could you please comment on the difficulty auditors are having signing off going concern-based accounts and the knock-on effect that has on the ability of companies in difficulty to raise fresh capital?
Sure. Let me quick, I agree 100% with Wolf. And the last question first, something very important is that this is something that you're going to have to watch. It'll be great for Wolf's and Teneo's business over time. Not only is the government heavily involved now, but because of the massive debt, the United States for the first time will have 100% of GDP in debt. And the states are in worse situations. The states are going bankrupt because they really fund the unemployment benefits, the Medicaid benefits. They didn't have a good fiscal situation beforehand. We'll have to see massive tax increases and other things on the table once we start coming out of this crisis. And there's going to be an active government to get funds back under control. And companies are going to have to really stay focused on that. But there is no other option. It's costing estimated $100 billion a week to be in this economic downturn, $500 billion almost a month that we got. The Federal Reserve and the government has to do everything they can to try and stop it and then worry about the repercussions on the other side. As far as your question on the auditors, Craig, I mean, there's a great focus on impairment issues, on goodwill valuation. There's a great focus on going concern, as was raised. But I will tell you, I'm incredibly impressed in all the companies' boards that I sit on and the CEOs that I still talk to. They moved to a virtual close of financial statements and books in virtually every company really seamlessly. Now, the smaller companies probably won't have that luxury. Some industries may have it harder. But I'm amazed at the way that the system continued to work and work extremely well in terms of gathering that information and presenting it to the governments from all the organizations I've seen. There will undoubtedly, as always be the case, second guessing of every decision that's made right now. So all I would say to everybody out there who's responsible for this, document simultaneously every decision, judgment, and assessment you make, because someone will come back after the fact and want to challenge it or sue you in the United States for sure, or somewhere else based on those judgments and assessments. It happens after every crisis. And there's good leeway, though, to win those with the business judgment rule and the ability to make best decisions with the information you have at the time is still what drives the end game. But really document, really consider all the factors, and be very authentic and transparent, and I think you'll be well situated.
Just very quickly.
Can I just say to Mark, I think that is one of the lessons from all of these crises that have happened. It was certainly the lesson from the Asian crisis, as I was involved, is that you've really got to document more than you do normally, because the look back, I'm not talking about in government, but the look back in the corporate world is just as profound, particularly when you're in a private equity owned company or a listed company. I think you just have to, you know, overwrite it up. You know, you literally have to document everything. I do think, though, Mark, that the pressure on the accounting industry, on the Big Four, is huge. And, you know, in Britain, they've got the FRC leaning on them. You know, they're getting pushed and pulled from every quarter. The newspapers are after them. It's an industry that's under siege. It really is.
And to your point, I'm sorry, Craig, but Mervyn, I've never understood it in all my years of running. You know, and I was the global head of the Big Four's group for a while. The UK has for a long time really just really been vigilant at going after the accounting profession. And so I think that will continue. It's not going to change just because of the pandemic for sure.
No, we started getting the bankers, then we went for the accountants. And, you know, who knows, Craig, it may be the...
accountancy insurrection is going to stop now, I'm afraid, Mervyn.
One more point. Craig, it's really important. It's just that to the question, what will happen is when oil prices go way down, when values go way down, other issues become material that the company never thought about before. So there's going to be a whole bunch of new issues that all corporations are going to be looking at. They never had to worry about as materiality changes. That's on the back of accountants to the question, and also the management to raise those issues, because there'll be some big changes there. Sorry.
No, that's no problem. Gilles from Whirlpool is saying, Amber, that the UK has not been in a real lockdown, and that is my worry, as people have not adopted self-preservation or protection measures, and this is impacting, putting at risk business continuity, even if allowed to operate. How to strike the right balance and ensure an effective re-acceleration of the economy? Amber.
You're right, the UK has not been in the same sort of lockdown as Spain or Italy, and I'm afraid I do think that the government's judgment there was right. I'm just not sure people would have put up with it. There were some references earlier to by Wolf to about having different countries having different cultures and different results, and I think in the UK it wouldn't have worked asking us to print out permission documents to go outside at all. So I think that the one that we've had is the only one that was feasible, but now it's going to be even more difficult to try and get people back to work because people have so bought into it that they're going to be reluctant to go out. I think that the best outcome that we can have is one where we have this phased easing, which I think is what we're going to get, but slow enough to bring up to speed the test, track and tracing, which the government is working so hard on trying to get up to speed, which will give us confidence again and which will allow businesses to be able to have confidences as well. I don't know whether we'll go as far as, for instance, Singapore, where if you haven't got the app, you're not allowed into buildings. It may be that in order to keep their unionised workforce happy, people may need, business owners may need to say, we're only going to have people back in who have got the app so that we can be certain it's not being passed on. Though all those decisions are for the future. But once we've got the app working, if we can, then all those choices will be available and will allow, I think, people to go back to work normally.
And Wolf, Nick Sedgwick is asking, does the panel believe that we will be going into a cycle of stronger and weaker versions of lockdown until next year? And what will the implications be? So, Wolf, for you.
I think certainly there is a possibility. When we look at the numbers, when we started easing in the lockdown in Italy, in Spain, in France, the number of positive cases per day were actually higher than they were when the lockdown was imposed. So you can say we know more about it, we got more data, we put some measures, but still the risk is there. There is a lot unknown. Yesterday, the Imperial College released a study on Italy where they look that if we don't keep the social distancing, if we don't use the mask, Italy will cases will go up very, very quickly. And they outline 8 different cities. So the risk is there. For me, as a political risk consultant, is how difficult will be the politics of that? First of all, because the economic drama will become even worse, because that will shatter any kind of confidence if suddenly in 3-4 months we have to impose lockdown. So the economy, the whole will become even bigger. And secondly, to create the political consensus required for a new lockdown, that will be a struggle, especially in countries where the various local administration, local leaders, regional leaders have invested their future into opening, and suddenly they get a call from the capital saying, well, it's time to lock down again. So the politics of the public health emergency that was politically kind of easy to handle the first round is likely to be much more difficult to handle the second round in a context where the economic situation will become far, far worse.
Sally Osman, your fellow senior advisor, Mervyn, has a question for you. Do you have anything further to say on the creative industries and sports, given most require mass gathering and live experience? They're important economically, but also for well-being and keeping spirits up.
Well, I think it's a key part of the economic growth story and success of the UK over the last decade or so. I think it's been a fantastic, you look at our strength in the UK, we've done really well in life sciences, partnership between unis and business, et cetera, but we have absolutely excelled in the creative industries. And I think the government will have to, there are all sorts of submissions going into the government, they will have to do a special fund for the creative industries and allocated with a panel, a bit like, the Future Fund is hugely important to the UK for technology companies and making that operational and making it successful over the coming month or two. And you know, they're making good progress on that, I think. But you'll need a creative industries fund, and you will have to support parts of the industry, otherwise it will disappear. And I think the unintended consequences of that are very profound, very profound.
Okay. So look, we've just coming to the end, we've just got a few minutes left, and I'm going to end with one avalanche question. Many thanks for the signal versus the noise point. Any ideas on how to distinguish between the two effectively? And I'm going to ask that to all of the panel, which is basically what is important and what's just noise here, really. So, Mark, you made the point, so why don't we start with you?
Sure, Craig, and thanks for the question. I would say, you know, the most important thing that any company leaders have to do is, one, have a great team around them, and two, listen a lot more than they talk. And when you listen to all your stakeholders, you have a better sense of what's really going on and focusing on the longer term issues. And by having empathy and understanding where their fears are and what they're thinking, you have a better understanding of how to address issues. And so I would say this is not an issue just for in crisis, but particularly when you're in crisis and you read the newspapers every day and you have employees jumping up and complaining, and you've got to balance all that amongst all your stakeholders. Don't get too tied to one small group of people you listen to. Listen to your investors, listen to your employees, listen to your supply chain owners, listen to your communities, listen to all those people, and then you have a better set, I think, better opportunity, better option, or better ability to have a long-term view and understand where things are going. And you'll still be probably wrong 50% of the time.
Okay, Amber, the signal versus the noise point.
Well, just to observe that for the past 10 years, most of which when I was in government, we did not have a challenge with unemployment. And the government is trying very hard now not to allow unemployment to soar like it's being, we're seeing it do in the US. And that is going to be obviously very, very difficult to maintain. But the strongest signal we're seeing from the government is about its commitment to furloughing, which is about heading off unemployment. And we will certainly see that extended. It's only lasting at the moment till the end of June. It'll probably be phased out over a period. But the most important signal is going to be about the government's commitment to reducing unemployment growth. And we will see that from the Chancellor over the next few weeks.
Mervyn, then Wolf, we've got a minute left. Mervyn.
I think, you know, you need IQ and EQ to be successful, just talking about business now, but this is a moment for EQ. You've really got to have antennae everywhere to soak up, as Mark said, and listen to what's going on. So you've got to have realism in your discussions with staff, your forecasting, and you've got to be very authentic. Don't pretend to know something about the future, because nobody, these are very uncertain times. So I think you get found out very quickly if you bullshit. So I think it doesn't matter whether you're in middle management or senior management, you've got to be very straight and say, I don't know how we're going to handle that, but what do you think? And so it's an appreciating and absorbing.
And Wolf, very briefly.
It's what we do every day in the political risk team at Teneo. It's about trying to understand what are the preferences of the actors involved and trying to understand what is actually doable, feasible, legally, politically, from the regulatory standpoint. Once you are able to do that, you will quickly realize that all the various options on the table become smaller. And then if you want to do a thorough job, you do a bit of scenario planning here, because as Mervyn mentioned, there is plenty of uncertainty out there. Nobody has got a crystal ball. You have to do scenarios here and prepare for each one of them.
Thank you. Well, that was another great insights call with another great panel. I know you'll all be giving a virtual round of applause as we do each week to Mark, Amber, Mervyn and Wolf. They were great. Thank you very much. And we will have another great panel next week. And I look forward to talking to you then. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thanks.